We will start off today by opening a work session to introduce a measure. And we have before us LC 2060. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move LC 2060 be introduced as a Judiciary Committee bill.
Senator Beyer has moved that LC 2060 be introduced as a Judiciary Committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Thank you. Now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 244. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 244 deletes a sunset provision relating to a convicted person's ability to request DNA testing of evidence. Last session, the Oregon legislature approved a bill to allow a person to request DNA testing of specific evidence if the person is either incarcerated as a result of an aggravated murder conviction or a person felony, or if the person was not in custody but had been convicted of aggravated murder, or a sex crime. The person needs to file a motion in circuit court accompanied by an affidavit, and the affidavit needs to have a statement that the person is innocent, a description of the specific evidence to be tested, and then a defense theory of the case. The bill is passed with a two-year sunset provision. What Senate Bill 244 does is to remove the sunset provision.
Okay, and committee, this was, authority to request DNA innocence is a very limited authority, and what we did last session was it extended this very limited ability to people who had actually pleaded guilty in their initial pleading. So we will start out with Andrea Meyer and Ann Christian.
Welcome. Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. I believe the table's been changed this year to make us feel all much shorter. It is a pleasure to appear here today.
The chair probably got lowered.
The chair got lowered, that's true, and I haven't changed. I'm pleased to appear here today in support of Senate Bill 244. And the ACLU of Oregon urges this committee to pass this bill. It's known as the Post-Conviction Motion for DNA Testing, and actually this law was originally passed in 2001 as Senate Bill 667. And it had at that time a four-year sunset and was limited in its scope, not applying to those who pled guilty. The law was supported at the time by ACLU of Oregon, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Indeed, there was no opposition. This law is quite limited in scope, and there are many safeguards that were intended to and indeed have prevented abuse. As counsel suggested, to invoke the provisions for testing, a defendant files a motion to the court along with an affidavit that must contain a statement of innocence, identification of the specific evidence to be tested, a theory of defense that DNA testing would support, the results of previous DNA testing if conducted, and presentation of a prima facie showing that testing of the specific evidence, assuming exculpatory results, would establish actual innocence. And in addition, any evidence tested under this law must have been secured in connection with the original prosecution. The court may also review whether or not the motion is being used for purposes of establishing innocence and can only order testing if all those conditions are satisfied. When we originally worked on this legislation, there was concern that it would be used by a large number of defendants seeking relief under its provisions, potentially imposing a financial burden on the state. I believe still to this day that has not happened. As the ACLU testified previously, DNA technology has been rapidly improving in recent years. Originally, this bill was intended only for those who may not have had access to DNA testing when convicted. But across the country, it has been established by those who previously had DNA testing that they are also being able to establish innocence. That means that in Oregon, we need to develop a scheme that takes into account the technology we don't know that will exist in 10, 20, or even 30 years from now.
Okay, Ms. Meyer, we have your testimony in front of us. Could you kind of summarize the rest of it? Thank you.
Senator Burdick, as I testified in the past, there are plenty of cases that have shown folks who've either not had access to or have access to testing who've been exonerated. And since 1992, the Innocence Project has helped exonerate 185 individuals, including 14 who were sentenced to death. Now, last session, you did add a change to the bill that was to add those who pled guilty. we had originally asked that the bill include those who pled guilty and remove the sunset to the law. But because there was concern about how much this could be used if we opened the door to those who pled guilty, we happily agreed to a two-year sunset again to let us look at the last 2 years, whether this law has been abused in any way whatsoever. And it has not. And as you recall, you passed out the amendments to expand it to those who pled guilty. It went to conference committee. It was unanimously supported by conference committee, which included representatives Krieger, Olson, and Barker, all whom have connections with law enforcement. So I believe it's truly bipartisan, and law enforcement as well as advocates on all sides who will support and have supported this. So we are back here this year asking that once and for all the sunset be removed because this is good policy to have. Now, the DAs have argued some concern with the pleading guilty, and we discussed that a great deal last session, and most of you were here. We had a case in Oregon where someone did plead guilty to avoid the death penalty when he had been faced a trial when his girlfriend had helped sort of set him up for a murder. It's all contained in my testimony in greater length, but she eventually recanted, and despite recanting, was convicted at trial. He then faced the death penalty, and so he pled guilty to a crime he did not commit. It was subsequently discovered that the real perpetrator was another person, and actually DNA evidence exonerated these two individuals, and this other individual was convicted for that crime. So innocent people do plead guilty. And when we're speaking of life and death matters, of imprisoning someone for most, if not all, of his or her life, we should not be afraid of offering DNA testing if it will exonerate even one person. Now, we believe some of the arguments that can be made again this year that were made in the past were that this law can reopen the matter for a crime victim who sought closure. But that argument doesn't follow a logical conclusion. There would not be any basis to reopen a case unless there was meritorious evidence of the innocence of the defendant and the DNA evidence available to prove innocence. And then no one is served, neither the public nor the victim, if an innocent person is incarcerated. No victim wants a false sense of closure when the guilty person is still free. In the past, the DAs have suggested that there will be substantial costs to law enforcement if the law was broadened, as it's been done. But that has not happened. The DAs may suggest a time limit period for how long someone can be able to access this to file a motion in the court. But again, we believe that defeats the very purpose of the law. It is critical that there be no limitation on when a motion can be filed because we cannot see into the future to know how and when technology will advance in such a way as to provide testing of evidence currently untestable. To put a time limit undermines the very concept that this bill provides a safety net in those rare situations when evidence is retained and technology now allows testing. So we would urge you not to consider any changes. We would urge you to pass this bill. We hope that this law will never be used. And indeed, it is so limited that while it's critical to keep it as a safety net, we should remember that it does not protect all Oregonians against any and all mistakes that might arise when innocent people are incarcerated. But we hope that if there ever was a case where an innocent person is incarcerated in Oregon and there is biological evidence available to be tested, and in those rare situations where the results would exonerate the individual, that we provide an avenue upon which the person, be they someone who pled guilty or was found guilty by a jury, may seek justice. We should not be afraid to have our justice system withstand that kind of scrutiny, and we urge you today to pass Senate Bill 244. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Ms. Christian.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Ann Christian. I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. As Ms. Meyer indicated, OCDLA was involved in 2001 in the original drafting of the legislation. And we're here today to say that we support Senate Bill 244 and the total elimination of any sunset on this provision. I was involved in the original, in a prior life, working for the state of Oregon in working on the fiscal impact statement for the original bill and spoke with a number of states. And fortunately, I would say, Oregon has not had the large number of cases that other states like Oklahoma had when they enacted these types. So the fiscal impact, I would agree with Ms. Meyer, has been much less than people thought. And so I would just close with saying OCDLA supports the bill as drafted with no amendments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay. Kevin Neely.
Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The Oregon District Attorneys Association does oppose the bill as it's drafted. I think that Ms. Meyer hit on a couple of the reasons that we do oppose it. I would say initially that the policy itself, the DAs do support. This is a good policy. We don't want to have innocent people behind bars. The challenges that the DAs have seen with this bill are really the challenges that Ms. Meyer already identified. The first relates to instances in which someone has pled guilty and then comes back later and seeks exoneration. Again, I think the principal reason that the district attorneys are at least would like to see some outside limit on this bill is so that there can be that closure for victims, so victims don't have to worry about 20, 30, 40 years down the line. But again, the fact is, here in Oregon, this bill has, the law has not been abused. The district attorneys acknowledge that. Again, the policy is a sound policy. What the district attorneys would like to see is some outside end, 5, 10 years after the appeals are completed. You know, so again, there'd be a good 20, 25-year window of time for this evidence to come in. We recognize that there are changes in technology. Perhaps another approach could be one in which, if there can be a reasonable finding that technology has changed, and because of that change in technology, it's time to let that evidence in, that could be pled to the court as well. So with that, I'd take any questions if the committee has any.
So are the district attorneys arguing that no one ever has pleaded guilty who was, in fact, not guilty?
Chair Burdick, I don't think that's the case. I think that they recognize that that does happen. Again, I think that their concerns center around, as I said, the final closure for the victim.
And is it your assumption that victims would rather have closure even if it meant that an innocent person had to stay in jail, to stay in prison?
Chair Burdick, I don't think that's the case. Again, I think at the end of the day, the concern has always been that there'll be those cases in which the victim has to come back, the victim has to go through it all again, and in fact, there won't be an exoneration.
So it would be better to sacrifice an occasional innocent person?
I don't think that's the case, Chair.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned change in technology language and look back. What about just extending the sunset on this current bill? Because I guess my question is, has anyone used this law in the last 2 years? And if they have, what were the results?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, the answer is this hasn't been used with any regularity whatsoever. And Ms. Meyer could probably give you more details as to if it's been used at all. But again, we've obviously supported a sunset on many occasions. The district attorneys have sought to get this a sunset in this bill. At this point, I think that I would hesitate to say that a sunset is the right answer. I do think that from the district attorney's perspective, we recognize that the bill hasn't been abused, and we'd just like to see some sort of definitive end to the process by which one could bring in this evidence.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. My understanding, and I would be more comfortable for those who actually administer this to speak specifically on it, but what I've heard anecdotally is that those who've invoked it, the process has been cut short with testing occurring so that the Oregon State Police can test it and proceed. I think there's been very few. I think last session I'd heard prior to that there was one who started the process and then forces stepped in. But it's critical to have that bill, that law there to allow the process, if there's something meritorious, to proceed in the way that the parties think is the most expedient to resolve it, be it going through the whole motion process or if everyone agrees to test to just proceed on that matter quickly.
Madam Chair, another question, I guess. I don't know if any of these witnesses can answer it, but what is the cost of reopening a case, and who bears that cost? Is it the state? Is it the county where the person was convicted? Is it the state police crime lab?
Senator Beyer, excuse me. My understanding that the only fiscal that was ever at issue in this was the Oregon State Police, and I believe they've not felt that there was any fiscal effect on this for the testing. There's been no case that's ever been reopened. I think if there's evidence that, again, exonerates someone, that the DAs would step in quickly, I would hope, and deal with the matters before a court. Again, this would be sufficient evidence to exonerate and not go through a whole trial again.
I think Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, if I would add to that, the other cost, of course, is if you get to that point, the indigent defense costs as well.
Then what?
The indigent defense costs. There would be public defender costs in most instances.
Right. But I think what Senator Beyer was trying to get at is, you know, who pays for the process itself if somebody invokes it?
Chair Burdick, I think the answer to that is, again, as with any prosecution, the first cost is borne by the police in doing the testing, the state police in doing the testing. And if, in fact, you move from that point, I believe the cost would be shouldered as usual. The prosecutors largely are paid for out of the county budget, and indigent defense is largely paid for out of the state budget.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, page 2, lines 25 onward, speak about the method for testing. If the person... This law is triggered for those who are no longer incarcerated, if it's murder, rape, or others, where there's still the punishment going on. If they are no longer incarcerated, they bear the burden of paying the cost. If they are incarcerated, it is the indigent, well, it's the Oregon State Police, the Department of State Police, to conduct the DNA testing if the parties don't agree to anything otherwise. So it would be the indigent defense to trigger potentially counsel to provide any assistance after the motion's been filed and the court has found that they've established all the thresholds and there's been a determination that actually evidence still exists. So then I believe they'd be appointed counsel to further assist in any process or proceedings that need to go on. And then we wait for the results.
Madam Chair, could either of these witnesses answer the question about what that would cost and what's it cost the state police to run these tests like this? I mean, the crime lab has been probably woefully underfunded in the last few sessions anyway, and if we're bringing in, you know, I just curious to know what the potential this is.
Well, Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I don't know the actual number. Ms. Christian may know, but I have been talking to the state police. They were more concerned last session with falling the cost because of what you said, because they've been behind. I spoke to them last week. They have no concerns about this bill in terms of affecting their budget. They have the resources because it's really not been used. And so if there's even one person in the next 4 or 5 years or 10 years that uses it, I don't believe it will greatly affect their budget.
They're pretty good about showing up, Senator Beyer.
Yes, they were here last.
Money that in their very lean budget.
Chair Burdick, members, Ann Christian from OCDLA. In 2001, I was the Director of Public Defense, Indigent Defense, and I wish I had total recall, so I'm not certain that I recall this, but the original bill, Public Defense, as Ms. Meyer indicated, would reimburse the state police for the cost of the state police doing the DNA testing, at least for those individuals who were incarcerated. So it was a cost to the state police that was reimbursed, if you will, from state funds for public defense. And I'm not certain if that has continued since I haven't been in the building last session. My memory is that the cost to the state police that then was billed to public defense was, I was going to originally say less than $100, but to be safe, since it was so many years ago, I would say under $300.
Okay.
One
Go
more
ahead.
Question, and I don't know if we have the right people up here, because someone from the crime lab may have to answer this question, but it's my understanding, the way I recall this from last session, is that, you know, with DNA, you're trying to prove somebody did something, and it's very difficult to prove a negative that somebody didn't do something by DNA. So I'd like to know, could somebody shed some light on that? I mean, just because there's absence of an evidence, that doesn't mean someone didn't do something.
Chair Burdick, Senator Barr, let me give you two examples where someone could use this evidence to help exonerate and where they couldn't. If there is a rapist and there was only one perpetrator and the rape included the biological evidence, semen, and they had that, and there was one of the cases that I mentioned in here where a long time ago it wasn't testable, but now it can be tested. If that is not the defendant, and there was no other sexual activity prior, that it would be anyone else's. If that is proved conclusively it's not the defendant, it would exonerate them. Let me give you another example where it wouldn't exonerate someone. You have two defendants, defendant A and defendant B. Woman is raped. Defendant A says, I wasn't there, it wasn't me. They come back with the DNA testing and it shows, indeed, that the sample doesn't belong to defendant A. It belongs to defendant B. Does that exonerate defendant A? No. Because there were two men there, and only one sample, it leads to B. It doesn't exonerate defendant A from being present. Am I making sense? So it's very narrow where the circumstance, it has to be, and that's what the bill language has, is evidence that would exonerate you. So it has to be the evidence that we know already was left by the perpetrator. In most situations, it's evidence that either technology allowed some testing, but it wasn't finite enough to be able to determine, or there was no testing available for that kind of sample, but that there's no debate that that result would indicate if it's the perpetrator or not. So it's very narrow. That's what we mean when we talk about being very narrow. Does that answer your
question? Yes, it does.
Mr. Neely, is there anything about removing the sunset that you think in itself would increase the caseload on this bill?
Chair Burdick, again, I think that remains to be seen. Obviously, if this bill does move forward, the DAs will be watching closely to see what happens, and if there is some sort of floodgate that opens, I think you'll see us back here to check in on things again. There isn't, again, clearly there's no evidence right now that this is just going to be used indiscriminately, and it's going to really drive a significant amount of cost. And it's hard to know whether or not the reason for that is because there's been a sunset or not. I think that, again, I'd like to think that that's not the case. And, in fact, it just hasn't been used.
But if it were the case, then the worst-case scenario would be you'd have to wait, only 1 year for a chance to fix it.
Certainly that's the case, Chair Burdick.
Andrea Meyer, I would think with the original bill, when there was that 2-year sunset originally on it, if there was going to be any rushing to the gates, it would have happened already.
Absolutely.
Because when it was passed, it had a closed window of opportunity. And that's the time where there could potentially be the most abuse, because people see that as a limited possibility. So I think we've seen, and I'm certainly happy if it ever in the future, as science changes, as technology, whatever these issues, because I think they're dynamic and they're evolving, but if there's ever the concern that Mr. Neely has, the ASA is committed to sitting down and working out to make sure that this law continues as it has been, not to be abused.
Okay.
One more question on that.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would there be any potential, I don't know the right wording here, but infringement on rights or something, to if you were to remove a sunset now and then at some point in time in the future go back and say, oh, there's too many people using it, we are going to put a sunset back in it. Would that be any kind of a sentence, change of a sentence or something like that, that would infringe on rights of a potential person?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I mean, this is a statute. It's not a right given in terms of a right under the Oregon Constitution, which you can't take away. I appreciate your question. I think it's going to be a moot point in the future, since I don't think this will be abused. But certainly if it were, there could be limiting ways to ensure that I think the abuse, we've put a lot of safeguards in here. A lot of safeguards of how someone even ever gets their evidence tested. But if that ever becomes a problem, then we need to look at what steps and hurdles and tinker with those if the process ever becomes one that there's way too many people using it and there's evidence that they are abusing it and using it other than for its intended purposes. So I don't think you'd run into any claim of removing a right. We would just fix, like we do in a lot of things, what processes do someone to get there. You have a due process in here. You're just fixing the process due to the person to get to it.
But, Madam Chair, under current law and under current, I guess, constitutional restraints, it seems that when we set sentencing guidelines. When we do something, if someone commits a crime during that time period, if you want to change that, you can't go back and retroactively change it for those people who have committed those crimes. You have to go from that point in time forward. You can't.
Chair Burdick, Senator Brock, I think that has, and maybe others can say, that has to do more with punishment. This is, we're giving folks an opportunity outside of the punishment system to bring forward evidence where otherwise we do not have a process. And the problem is technology got ahead of us. And we simply needed a process available in those circumstances that makes it easier for everyone involved in the system, the courts, the indigent defense, the prosecutors. If there's someone saying 20 years ago there needed to be testing done and it can be done now, they can spend a lot of time and a lot of resources imposing on all those branches and all those agencies to get the testing done. And what we've simply done is set up a really narrow process for everyone to know how to do it. But I don't think it would infringe on any of the rights you're concerned about if we tinker with it in the future if that's necessary. But I leave it to...
Well it also seems to me that if situation developed where something completely new and unforeseen happened, the next legislature, whenever it meets, next year, year after that, could slap a sunset back on it. But what I'm trying to get at is, does the sunset give us anything? I mean, does it slow down anything? I mean, it doesn't seem like it would, but given the track record, but is the sunset itself...
Senator Burdick, it gives me the opportunity to be in front of you every 2 years.
Chair Burdick, I get to say, I mean, remember, let's not forget, the courts get to look at anyone filing this. It's not automatic. It's not if you present this affidavit and all this stuff, you get it. The courts still must look and say, yeah, you're playing the system. There's no evidence here. You can't do that.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, of course, my main experience in this body has been in human services, and quite often we will implement programs or make changes to programs and put sunsets on them so we can review them. And in most cases, we will extend the sunset, well, continue to extend it well past the time we think it's working, just to make sure that something strange isn't going to happen. And the one thing the sunset does is force us to make the review. And, I mean, this has been, I mean, the last change was last session. I guess I'm just wondering why the rush to remove a sunset rather than continue to review and make sure it's working right. You know, of course, this is a different field than I'm used to, so maybe the rules are different here.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, but if there were a lot of people using it, I would feel more comfortable with the sunset, just to make sure that people aren't slipping through and so on. But the fact of the matter is that nobody's using it.
Well, I guess, so you know, Madam Chair, you could assume that initially when there was a sunset, there would have been a rush to it, but then maybe not. Who knows, maybe some of the jailhouse lawyers haven't found it yet. I don't know.
Oh, they found it.
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, can I give you a little history? Actually, after we...
Let's let Ms. Christian say something first.
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, to answer your question, it's really a good question, because if this were criminal law, you could not in the future go backwards and affect people who were convicted under criminal law. But I thought of in the late 1980s, early 90s, there were some changes made to what's called post-conviction relief. So if I'm convicted of a crime, after my appeals, I have a right, and it's very similar to what we're talking about today, to challenge, and it's usually the competency of my lawyer. And in the late 80s, early 90s, there were restrictions, greater restrictions put on an inmate's right to do post-conviction relief. And at some point it was decided that those restrictions needed to be made smaller. And there was that concern, well, what about these people who assumed they had 1 year to file something? Now we're going to 120 days. And so my memory, and it's a long time ago, is that there was like a savings provision for individuals who are currently incarcerated, and it was basically you've got 1 year and that's it, and anyone new gets 120 days. So I think there's some history as far as how, if you need to intervene in this, how it could be done without running afoul of anyone's rights. I agree with Ms. Meyer, they aren't constitutional rights, so you don't have to be as concerned as far as fashioning a remedy to deal with it.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. We'll close the hearing. No, wait a minute. We'll wait and we'll ask if anybody else in the audience, having heard all this testimony, wants to say anything. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 244. Committee, I think this needs to be reauthorized. I'd be happy to put a sunset on it if I thought there was anything to be gained by it, and I don't see anything to be gained by a sunset. So,
Madam Chair, from my perspective, you gain at least one vote if you put an extension of the sunset on for 4 years. If that means anything to you.
Well, I appreciate that.
Well, Madam Chair, and not a two-year, four-year would be, I think, appropriate in this case. I'd just like it to run. That's just kind of the way I view the way we do things. We're test driving everything we do. So.
Well, and I could just remind the committee that most of the bills we pass through here do not have any kind of sunset on them.
Right.
And the intention is if they're not working, then they come back, and there's just been no evidence in the two cycles that these sunsets have existed. There's just been no evidence, in my view, to dictate a sunset.
Yeah, I guess that, I go back to, I think it was Ronald Reagan said the closest thing to eternal life on earth is a government program or policy. And it's at least if you go out, because the first one, I think, which was for all inmates, had a four-year sunset. And then that was removed last session, is that correct? And then this is just for those who plead guilty at time of...
No. This is for the whole program. The whole program.
Okay. So it was first a four-year and then a two-year sunset?
Yeah. So it's when was 6 years of sunset.
When was the...
Can we bring back Ms. Myers to answer that?
I was looking at Craig Prince because he was on Judiciary in 01. I thought this was...
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, the first proposal was limited and didn't include those who pled, and it was 4 year statute of limitations, an opportunity to review it. Prior to that session, at that time, a representative from the DAs said, no problem, let's just remove the sunset entirely. ACLU came in and said, we'd like the amendment to include those who pled guilty. In exchange for concerns that might open up new floodgates, we said, sure, let's put a 2 year sunset in, just to safeguard that additional step. So it would really be our hope that we would now once and for all remove the sunset because we've really load tested this for many years. Does that answer your question in terms of the original and the subsequent?
You have the history more than I do.
Sadly, I know this quite well. So right, originally it was 4 years and then a decision to remove it, and I think if we had not come in with our amendment last session, I think it would have been my hope and expectation that we would have simply removed the sunset altogether and that it would have existed in the books. And we were happy to do a 2 year with our amendment because we were confident that it wouldn't be abused, but we also eagerly ask you now once for all to remove the sunset.
But this program is only in its second year, then not its sixth year.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, for only those who pled guilty. I mean, that's a very rare circumstances.
Yes,
right. For those who pled guilty, who maintain their innocence, who have DNA that wasn't tested, that could be, again, all the criteria that we talked about has to be satisfied. But if you look at my testimony, there is that one case in Oregon where he did plead guilty and he was innocent because he was facing a death penalty. Now, the DNA evidence that they found, the person who was eventually convicted led law enforcement to that DNA evidence. The individual who's incarcerated would have been left there forever because he didn't have any DNA evidence to exonerate. So it was an unusual circumstance, and I think we should all be happy that it came to light. But even in that case where an innocent person went to jail, he didn't have, even if this law had been in the books, it wouldn't have helped him. It was by happenstance that they found the culprit, and he confessed to it.
Okay. We are in work session. Senator Walker, would you have a motion?
Sure, Madam Chair. I would move Senate Bill 244 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 244 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Any objections? Yeah, I'm objecting.
Okay. Why don't you call the roll?
Senator Cruz?
No.
Yastrzemski?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Byer?
No.
Chair Burke?
Aye. Okay, this is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I will carry this bill. Now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 296. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 296 is the so-called marijuana classification fix. What it does is it removes a reference to delivery of marijuana as being a crime category 8. And it also then classifies delivery of a controlled substance in Schedule 1, 2, or 3 to a person under the age of 18 as a crime category 8. And it classifies delivery of marijuana to a person under 18 by a person over 18 and at least 3 years older than the person under 18 as crime category 8.
Okay, and this was the bill that is necessary to correct an error that was made in the meth package during the last session that none of us caught. And I would hope that we would be able to discuss this and dispense with this quite rapidly. Craig Prince.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Craig Prince. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, and thank you, Council, for describing this bill. It's exactly that. It's a fixed bill. When we passed the meth package last session, Senate Bill 907, the Criminal Justice Commission asked that we break out the crimes in the ORS Chapter 475. We did that so we could follow the different crimes and tell policymakers more about what type of crimes people are being arrested for or convicted of. Currently, under the statute as it existed in 05, really all of the drug crimes were one statute number, ORS 475.992, and then it broke them all up. We broke them all up, and then I made made it clear that we wanted to keep everything the same as far as the sentencing guidelines grids for everything. Well, we made one Scrivener's mistake, is my understanding, and this is the correction to that, and that is for delivery of marijuana for consideration. Mr. Stanford, did I get that right?
You did.
I'm nervous about this because I already made one mistake on it.
Careful with the record here, Mr. Prince.
I know. It was a 4, and this arguably made it an 8 by error. So the part that I think the part that takes care of that is on page 2, line 41. You see where the bracketed ORS is 475.860. If you delete that from that deletes the problem that delivery of marijuana for consideration will be treated as an 8. And I think that takes care of it. I do have one question for counsel. I want to make sure that I got this right. May I?
You may.
Mr. Stanford, on page 3, line 5, I want to make sure I understand this part. If you look at line 5, this is where we start talking about level 6 drug offenses. And legislative counsel has added 475.904 or 475.906 to that statute. And I'm not sure why that is, because those two statutes deal with manufacturing and delivering within 1,000 feet of a school and distributing to minors, which neither of those was a 6, ever was a 6. So there's probably
Were they before?
They were 8s. And so there's probably a good reason for that I'm not aware of. And so I just wanted to see if Mr. Stanford had talked to counsel or if we should double back with her to make sure that we got this right. because obviously what I want to do is make sure everything is what it was before and we didn't make any sentencing changes that were unintended.
Right. If it was an 8 before, it needs to be an 8 now.
Right. And I guess the way I would put it is I couldn't figure out a way that a violation of ORS 475-904 should be a 6 under, or, and the same is applied to 475-906. I can't think of that situation where it would supposed to be a 6. So I don't know why it's in that list.
Thank you, Mr. Prince.
Sorry about diming you up on that one to see if you could help me out. But
on 904, which is an unlawful manufacture or delivery within 1,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
and applies to, my understanding of 904 is it's sort of a catch-all for any Schedule 1, 2, or 3 substance that's not previously listed.
Okay.
So we're talking about sometimes like different kinds of oxycodone pain medications
okay.
that aren't classified elsewhere. Is oftentimes what this covers, and it talks about that within 1,000 feet of a school.
Okay.
Your question is whether or not, how can a violation of 904 within 1,000 feet of a school ever be a Category 6?
Correct.
And give me just 1 second to get a handle on this.
Are you saying now it's an 8?
Yeah, this looks like a mistake to me.
Presently, if you deliver any one of the listed offenses, that when I say listed offenses, what I'm talking about are marijuana, cocaine, ecstasy for short, methamphetamine, or heroin, within 1,000 feet of a school, it's always going to be a crime category level 8.
Okay.
Always. And what this appears to talk about is if you're delivering oxycodone, just one that comes to mind that's not one of those listed ones but is still a Schedule 1, 2, or 3 within 1,000 feet of a school, it's a crime category 6.
And that's what I just, Senator, I want to make sure I get this right the first time. So I wanted to check, and I didn't have an opportunity to check with legislative counsel on this before because I just caught that. So what I wanted to let you know that the bill is the bill to fix this situation to make sure that marijuana for consideration stays a 4. It does that, and I'm just on, that's on page 2, that where it takes out that bracket. I'm just unclear what that language on page 3 does, and I want to check with legislative counsel to see if there's a reason that I'm not getting, which is very possible.
Yeah, I'm not willing to move this until
okay.
we get that answered, because to me this looks like they're moving it to a 6, and yet they refer to heroin, cocaine, meth,
yeah.
and all these things
so,
down below.
So I take full responsibility for the error in the first place. It was because of the we didn't catch it in the first place. It's not. I just want to make sure I get it right the first time. So I would love the chance to talk to the drafter to make sure I understand what that page 3 is, and I'd love the chance to come back once that's straightened out.
Okay, I would appreciate your assistance with counsel to go check with the drafter, and our intent is clearly not to reduce any existing penalties
okay.
that were there before the meth bill passed.
All right.
And our intent is to make the marijuana penalty consistent with what it was before we passed the meth bill.
Thank you.
I'm sure.
Senator Pisanski.
Can I also ask, based on this last part of the discussion on page 3, it looks like we got some pretty heavy-duty stuff that looks like they're going to potentially be a 6 versus an 8, where you've got others that are going to be at an 8. And, you know, it just seems to me if we're trying to deal, especially on the methamphetamine, why would they be at a level 6 versus the ones that Mr. Prince went through that said, and counsel said, that would stay as an 8 all the time?
Well, but that's existing law, and
I understand that, but it seems to me we're here to have some equity here as to, you know, the concern of the substances that are listed. It just seems to me, why would we be treating meth at a 6, and I thought I heard marijuana at an 8, or...
No, that's not true.
Okay.
Counsel?
If I can respond to that, I believe, Senator.
Okay.
Under existing law on... if you have a delivery of any one of the, I'll call them primary drugs, and when I say that, heroin, cocaine, meth, ecstasy,
And marijuana?
No, no, not marijuana. If you have a delivery for consideration, okay, which is, as you know, is just for money or for whatever, something, just a straight up delivery for consideration under present law is a crime category 6 for any one of those, and that's what 2A refers to.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that it doesn't rise to the level, as you know, of commercial drug offense, et cetera.
Right.
2B goes through and lists what we call substantial quantities. Well, the substantial quantities of drugs that are listed in 2B, it's a crime category 6, but if you look at 2B, it says possession. So just possessing a lot is a crime category 6.
Okay.
If you were to deliver
then you go to the
and
eight.
Have a lot, you jump to the 8.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you for the explanation.
Okay, is that satisfying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, well, we will look into this and bring this bill back, possibly with an amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Close the hearing on Senate Bill 296. Okay. My experience is it's always easier to make a mistake when you've already made a mistake. It just seems to be the way it goes. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 298. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 298 has to do with a person's permanent revocation of driving privileges under ORS 809.235. Under present law, if a person is convicted of felony driving under the influence of intoxicants or DUI, or if persons are convicted of misdemeanor DUI for a third or subsequent time, they suffer a lifetime suspension of their Oregon driver's privileges. Right now, as it stands, a person can be convicted a third time for a DUI, but it doesn't involve a motor vehicle. It involves a bicycle, commonly referred to by many DAs as pooies, for pedaling under the influence of intoxicants. So you can lose your driving privileges if you pick up a pooey, and the pooey is your third DUI conviction.
Madam Chair, that must be something from the north part of the state, because down in the south we call them buoys.
The buoys? Biking. Thank you. What Senate Bill 298 does is it addresses this situation and says no more permanent revocation for a pooey or a buoy, depending on where you live and stay.
Okay, well, with that wonderful intro, Ann Christian.
Do they make wooies too, Madam Chair?
Walking under the influence.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's
are coming.
I think that's DIP. Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers has had a bill to decriminalize, if you will, BUI, which is what the OCDLA calls bicycling under the influence. And I want to just make clear that is not this bill. Senate Bill 298, as counsel explained, merely addresses the situation where a person is bicycling under the influence, or I've learned from Mr. Neely, rafting under the influence is also an example of an individual who is operating a vehicle under Oregon law. A vehicle includes bicycling, boat law includes non-motorized boats, and so if today I'm bicycling and I've been drinking to the point that I'm intoxicated, I would be found guilty of driving under the influence, because driving under the influence does not require that an individual is in a motorized vehicle. Again, OCDLA is not suggesting that that be changed. As counsel pointed out, this Senate Bill 298 only addresses a misdemeanor DUII, does not even go to the issue of a felony driving under the influence as far as a permanent revocation of the person's driver's license. And in part, the reason that we have pursued this bill is that we like to believe that there's a rational basis for criminal laws as well as administrative sanctions. And if an individual is bicycling under the influence, there's no tie. It's a safety hazard for sure. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But there's no tie, if you will, to their driver's license. And I understand that the District Attorneys Association will either be neutral or support this bill. In talking with Mr. Neely, I do agree with the District Attorneys Association that in a sentencing hearing where the defendant is saying, I shouldn't have a permanent revocation of my license, as I indicate in the written testimony, there still would be a license suspension of 1 or 3 years. It just wouldn't be a lifetime revocation. That there really ought to be the burden on the defendant as opposed to the district attorney to prove that, for instance, 10 years ago, my prior conviction for driving under the influence involved a canoe or a bicycle. And so we OCDLA agrees with the need to add that within the bill, and one thing we were going to suggest is that's something we agree to and could be handled perhaps on the House side if you were inclined to go that direction. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have on this bill.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Pazanski.
Thank you. Just a couple of things, I guess, for clarification. The currently, under the law, if a person is suspected of biking under the influence, they're not required to take a breath test because that actually goes against their license. So it sounds to me what you're trying to do here is kind of mirror that. But the one thing I wasn't sure, and when you were giving your presentation, if someone has a DUI that's based on a bicycle, mm-hmm. and is that still going to be counted toward the third conviction for being charged with a felony?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So this bill does not change the law whatsoever with regard to felony DUII. Legislative Council asked whether we wanted to go that far, and we decided no. If someone racks up that many DUIs within a short period of time, that's not addressed. Thank you for asking that.
Yeah, I think just for perspective, I mean, there are individuals who get cited for DUI. They lose their license, then they're on a bike,
mm-hmm.
and they're a buoy. And I would just want to mm-hmm. make sure that that doesn't become a fail-safe, that now if I just bike, they're not going to count against me as you would, let's say, actually count them toward felony treatment. But I mean, I'll say this, Madam Chair, it does make sense that if we currently in the state, which we do not have implied consent laws apply to someone operating a bicycle under the influence, this makes sense as to its limited framing of what it's wanting to address, because we can't force an individual to take the breath test if they're on a bicycle.
Well, then that raises the question of how do they, is it just field tests that they use to determine if they're drunk?
Yeah, I mean, you have potentially a person, even if they're in a vehicle, refusing to take the field sobriety test or refusing to take the breath test. Now, we've made arrangements or we have laws that you can actually bring that before the trier of fact for them to take in consideration. But there is no authority to require someone to take the breath test if it's alleged that they committed the offense while they're biking.
Because I can't figure out without that how they would get convictions.
Well, think of this. Before we had the magic machines that would read someone's breath, we had people being cited all the time, and it was either you blow in a balloon, of course, and then you test that. But out back in the 60s and 70s, I guess, that stage. But many times we have individuals who are being charged with that offense and they refuse for whatever reasons to take the scientific-based test to measure their blood alcohol level. And it's based on field sobriety test. Or if they are involved in an accident and they're getting medical treatment, there can be a blood draw based on that. And that way you would get it. But unfortunately, I guess you don't have as many people at least being pulled over for a buoy.
I was going to say, there are a lot of drunk bikers rolling around.
Don't know.
Senator Byer.
Thank you. I'm just trying to make sure I'm reading this right. And the way the current law is, it's for a a third or subsequent time on a conviction, and now you're saying at least three of those have to be while driving a motor vehicle. So if a person gets it a third time and it's on a bike, it doesn't count.
Correct.
But it does count. I mean, it still goes in the record or something, but they can't lose their driving record. But if they get it done again, it would count. So as far as if they get another one of driving, then at that point in time, this kicks in. So that it's not three in a row, or it's not three out of three. It's when you get the third while driving a motorized vehicle.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't think that's the case, and I think examples sometimes help us think through these, because what Senate Bill 298 would provide is that current law says if I have three convictions for driving under the influence, and that could have been I was on a bike all three times, but current law says then my license will be revoked for a lifetime. And what this bill changes then is that all of the convictions, all three of the convictions necessary to take away my license for lifetime have to be driving a motorized vehicle under the influence. So any combination of two driving a motor vehicle and one bicycle will not result in the permanent revocation, all the way down to, and I've never known this to happen and I've never heard of anyone, but three bicycling under the influences would not result in a revocation, whereas under current law they would.
But if one of them is a bike, they would still get a suspension.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, if a person had two prior convictions, and it depends on the time frame, but let's say two prior convictions within the last 5 years and then picks up another driving under the influence that's a bicycle, they still would have a three-year license suspension. Nothing in this bill changes that, and that's what I've provided.
Only the permanent revocation.
Right. Okay. That's what I've provided in my written testimony. So they still suffer consequences for certain. They're convicted of a crime, and they have a three-year license suspension.
But they can still ride their bike and be drunk, correct?
Well, if they do and they're caught, they can be prosecuted for driving under the influence, because it doesn't have to be a motorized vehicle.
Madam Chair, but basically the license is suspended for 3 years, which means they can't drive a car,
right.
But they could still get on their bike and be drunk and continue to do that over and over and over again, correct?
Right.
Correct, but
Chair
even
Burdick,
if it was a lifetime revocation, they could still do that. Because you don't need
I understand
it.
That.
Exactly.
I do understand that, but I guess I'm
but
looking
take
at
the
it.
Bike away?
Well, I'm looking at it and saying just because you're on a bike when you're drunk doesn't mean you're not a danger to yourself and others. So.
Oh, that's correct. Well,
Chair
I have a perfect
Burdick.
Solution. They should take away their road bikes and give them to the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Bike if it's okay. But
we'll negotiate
okay.
That, Senator Cruz. Are there any other questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Neely.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, District Attorney's Association. Ms. Christian pretty much already gave my testimony. The district attorney's very convenient. The district attorneys do not oppose this bill, so long as we're able to amend it to ensure that the burden of proving that the individual was not on a motorized vehicle falls to the defendant.
Okay. All right. Just before we are there questions to this witness?
Madam Chair, I'm assuming a motorized scooter is considered a motorized vehicle because it has a motor. It's out there on the roadway.
It is, but I think there's actually like a moped may not be. I just want to make sure we're on the record. I think there may be a threshold of I want to say CCs, because I think all of those, but I think there's maybe a moped. I'm not sure how that's defined, if it's considered motorized or not. But pretty much they are.
You know, this raised a question. Maybe I'm opening a Pandora's box here, but is what you really intend with this is to only revoke the license for those kinds of vehicles for which a license is required?
Correct.
Is that what the intent of this is? Because there are some...
It is, but it isn't, because if you heard what she said, if you're... For the permanent revocation, which is actually a minimum of 10 years, mm-hmm. that isn't going to be impacted. But if it is your second conviction within a... Well, if it's your first conviction, you lose your license for a year. Mm-hmm. And if you have a second conviction within a five-year period, then there's a three-year suspension that goes. And those both could be biking under the influence or pooey, and end up with those suspensions. So I don't know if we're going to another 2 years or 4 years see a request for us to look at that again. But I think there's some... The ramification for the permanent revocation is a minimum of 10 years. And I think what everyone's looking at and everyone's in agreement for a bicyclist to suffer that is maybe out of proportion compared to someone that's driving a 2,000 to 5,000 pound vehicle that's mm-hmm. that much more of a hazard to them and others.
Okay, so then the issue becomes mopeds and motorized scooters.
What about riding lawnmowers? You're
that's
mowing your lawn in your backyard, drinking a lot of beer.
You're on a public highway or premises open to the public.
Right.
Unless you've got to say, come in free. If you're doing like yard sale, then you may be in problems there. So.
Yeah, we're going to be, in all likelihood, ordering up an amendment on this. So I just want to make sure that we craft the amendment so that, one approach would be to cover all motorized vehicles, no matter if it has a motor, it's covered.
Correct.
The other option is to somehow try to narrow it down to only having the permanent revocation for vehicles for which a license is required.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that would let in some mopeds, I imagine. I mean, I see little kids riding around on these.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think you may want to think twice about that, because you get some of the ATV stuff
mm-hmm.
that does not require a license, but it's just as dangerous and deadly, and it's motorized.
Madam Chair, you also get into boats then, too.
Pardon?
You also get into boats,
yeah,
and that brings in, I know that...
Yeah,
that
boating under the influence.
Yeah, boating under the influence is a problem that mm-hmm. we still want
okay,
to make sure...
Okay, so let's just leave it motorized and...
Okay, so boats are not in this?
No.
Okay.
I think
so I was going to get down, Madam Chair, to you could have a drift boat with a little troll motor that's, what, 3 horses or something like that, and then suddenly you're...
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I would say boats are not included so long as they have no motor.
Define motor.
Well, uh-huh. if I could, I'll read the definition of vehicle. Vehicle means, and this is 801-590, so vehicle is the term for conviction for driving under the influence. You have to be driving a vehicle, and it includes bicycles. So here's the definition. Vehicle means any device in, upon, or by which any person or property is or may be transported or drawn upon a public highway, and includes vehicles that are propelled or powered by any means. So by legs, powered by legs, or powered by oars.
What we need is a definition of motorized.
And motor vehicle and I found moped, which is also defined. Motor vehicle means a vehicle that is self-propelled mm-hmm. or designed for self-propulsion.
Hmm. Yeah, which would be a trolley motor. It would be self-propelled, and New Waters of the State, I mean, they're part of the transportation system, so boats would be included, I would think.
Motorized boats.
Yeah. What I'm saying is you could have a rowboat. You got a little troll motor
right.
on it, so you can be stationary in the current to fish.
But that would be a motor.
That would be included in this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Interesting.
Okay. All right, so we'll get an amendment drafted for this bill to put the burden on the defendant. That will make everybody happy.
And Chair Burdick, just to correct, Senator Cruz just said that the little troll molder would be included in this bill as far as not being subject to the revocation.
No, it would
excluded,
be.
Excluded, yeah.
Yes. Just wanted to make sure the
subject
record's
to,
clear.
Yeah. Subject to revocation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, close the hearing on Senate Bill 298. Open the public hearing on next bill, Senate Bill 299. Counsel.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, this is Senate Bill 299, and this relates generally to bicycle laws. There are five primary changes to the Oregon Vehicle Code involving bicycles that arise out of Senate Bill 299. The first is that it creates a new Class D violation for the offense of operating a bicycle at a speed greater than an ordinary walk when the bicyclist is at or near a crosswalk and a motor vehicle is approaching. Number two, it creates a Class B violation for motor vehicle drivers who pass bicycles at distances closer than 3 feet. Third, it amends an existing violation for the unsafe operation of a bicycle on a sidewalk. And the amendment relates to the standard for speed. Presently, the standard that's prohibited, the speed that's prohibited, is speed greater than an ordinary walk. What Senate Bill 299 changes that to is speeds greater than reasonable under existing conditions. Number four, the fourth change Senate Bill 299 does is it allows an exception to passing in a no-passing zone violation on narrow roadways when a motor vehicle can safely pass a bicycle by crossing the center line. And then the fifth and final primary change that Senate Bill 299 does is it amends the prohibition on operating a motor vehicle in a bike lane by creating an exception for either A, the driver of the motor vehicle is trying to avoid a hazard or an obstacle, or B, if the driver is safely passing a vehicle making a left turn but passing that vehicle on the right.
Thank you, Council. And now bring on the bikers, Scott Bricker, Doug Perro, and Ray Thomas. Like your pin, I have about six of them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having us today. For the record, my name is Scott Bricker. I'm the Policy Director at the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And with me, we have a small panel. We have Doug Perro, who is a BTA board member, and Ray Thomas, who's a member of our legislative committee. So thanks for having us. We'll try and keep it concise here. The BTA is a nonprofit organization, and we try and improve conditions for bicycling, for the bicycling industry, for children, for senior citizens, for the community, for tourism. We try and make it safer and more of a practical thing to do. We also, in the legislature, try and work on making sure that bicycle laws are fair and safe. And since actually some of the bicycle laws are relatively new compared to vehicle code, we are in the process of tweaking those. So today we have some issues that involve bicycling in a variety of circumstances that we hope will increase safety and again tweak the codes in a couple different places. I do want to know before we do our panel here that we are in discussion with a variety of people about these issues. We're talking with senators on the committee, members of representatives of the transit community, the trucking community, and other folks to try and deal with concerns or just clarifications. And we're also trying to explain these to even our own constituency, the bicyclists, to how some of these things will preserve their rights and make it safer and clearer between motorists and bicyclists. So I'd like to introduce Doug and move along.
Thank you. If you could introduce yourself for the record, that would be great.
Chair Burdick, my name is Doug Perro. I live at 6782 Amy Lane Northeast in Kaiser. I am a member of the BTA Board of Directors. I've been tasked with the responsibility to just kind of briefly walk you through the bill and talk a little bit about what it does. And I'll try to, like I say, make that brief. We see the bill as a couple different sections as operating in tandem, and so I'll kind of jump out of order. Sections 2 and 4 are really closely related, and we see those two sections as, like I say, operating in tandem. And in that regard, the summary of the bill, the printed summary, I think is a little bit misleading and perhaps not exactly accurate in terms of what the bills are trying to accomplish. What the bill would do is would differentiate between the speeds that cyclists are authorized to operate, differentiate between crosswalks and other situations in which the bicycle and an automobile motor vehicle paths cross. So what Section 2 does is pulls out from basically the concepts in the existing language in ORS 814.410, which is amended in Section 4. What Section 2 does is really addresses then the question of the speeds and the responsibilities of a cyclist when crossing a crosswalk. and it would establish the expectation that the cyclist not enter the crosswalk at a speed faster than an ordinary walk, which is existing law, and then would allow the cyclist to accelerate once in the crosswalk and to continue on through the crosswalk. Section 4, then, what we're proposing is Section 4 amends the existing statutes so as to pull out of the existing statutes the references to crosswalks and deal solely with driveways and other kinds of situations that frequently intersect the intersect sidewalks. And the standard then that would be established under Section 4 in terms of a cyclist who is riding on a sidewalk, and from the BTA standpoint that is typically used because we encourage adult cyclists to ride on the street, but it would then establish the standard for a cyclist on the sidewalk as to not cross a driveway or other curb cut at a speed that is faster than is reasonable given the circumstances. The existing law, as established in ORS 814.410, would be that the cyclist would have to slow down at each drive walk to the speed of an ordinary walk. And so we really view those two sections as operating in tandem, dealing then with crosswalks alone in Section 2, and then dealing with other kinds of situations in which the path of a motor vehicle would intersect a sidewalk in Section 4. Did I make that sufficiently confusing?
As you were talking, I was visualizing early in my daughter's biking career when we got stuck on Highway 99 in Kaiser. And I don't know how we ended up on that road, but if it hadn't been for sidewalks, we probably wouldn't either of us be here today.
Chair Burdick, most of us avoid River Road for that reason. The other, another concept that's in the bill, and it deals with, in sections 3 and 5, then encompass this concept, are those around overtaking and passing bicyclists. And we really view these two sections as really a clarification of the law, and we really don't think that that substantively they make significant changes in the statute. Existing law, as it pertains to vehicles passing other vehicles using the roads, requires the overtaking and passing vehicle to maintain a safe distance from the overtaken vehicle. Unfortunately, our experience is that many motorists don't understand what that means in the context of passing a bicyclist. So what the bill proposes is that we establish a 3-foot minimum distance to provide a quantifiable standard in statutes describing that distance. Now, we are aware that there are concerns about that standard from both sides, quite frankly, because at speed, 3 feet is not enough. At higher speeds, really 3 feet is too close to be safe. And so we, like Scott said, we do understand that we need to work with the various groups and see if we can come up with some amendments and a better way to approach this particular situation. The related part of that is that currently the statutes allow a motorist to cross the center line in a no-passing zone when necessary to avoid an obstruction. And so we really view our proposed language as really clarifying in the statutes that, I guess in that concept, a bicycle operating at a substantially lower speed than the overtaking automobile does constitute an obstruction. And so we're proposing that that we make it clear that it's okay to cross the center line in a no-passing zone in order to go around a cyclist. And like we say, we really think that the existing statutes probably do allow that. This would make it clear that is that allowed, hopefully from a public education standpoint, if nothing else, so that we get people giving us more space.
Madam Chair?
Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Here's my problem with Section 3, and I go to my part of the country where the roads are are fairly wide. I mean the lanes are fairly well prescribed, and there's a fog line, and then there would be like maybe 4 or 5 feet to the right of the fog line, and bicyclists are riding to the left of the fog line, and this puts all the onus on the car, motor vehicle driver, to make sure that the separation's there and there's nothing on the bicyclist when they should be clear way to the right of the fog line in the safe zone, but they aren't. They're either on it or to the left of it. And so then I'm in violation because they're in my space in situations like that, and that's what, there's no onus. I mean, it's totally one-sided here.
But they're not in your space. They're in their space. The law that's currently in place says that they have the right to that lane that you are in, just like they are, because they're a vehicle. The area that's to the right of the fog line is not a lane. Sometimes they're designated as a bicycle lane,
mm-hmm.
and as you well know, there are places in Douglas County that have no, there's no shoulder. There's just the white line right on the edge. And so, I mean, I have some issues with this, I think the pictures here really demonstrate what the problem is. If you have a bicyclist that just fell over like an Artie Johnson in a Laugh-In skit, you can see that they're going to fall further than 3 feet when they fall off that bike. And if someone believes that they, and we prescribe that they're legally okay to be 3 feet away, I think we're set up a perception for that could be fatal, and has been, in fact. And I guess in response to the panel, the district attorney, at least in Lane County, totally agrees with your position that the motor vehicle can move over the center line of a no passing lane to pass a obstacle, because that's how they ruled in a fatality that happened in May. And so, I mean, that's clearly there, and I understand that you may want to have a little bit more education for people to understand to do that, because if they understand it, they will move, or they will not fear moving over, so they'll be more safe. But I know that we're going to work on this, but the issue is to the, you know, I think the education is that they are vehicles. They have every right to be on the right, or they're supposed to be furthest to the right as safe in the lane. Now, if we're going to make a change and say that the fog, if there is a shoulder that bicycles shall ride on that, then that's something that we should discuss. But the reality is there's many rural roads that I ride that do not have any type of a shoulder. And the situation I'm describing for the fatality that I'm very familiar with, the lanes there were 9.5 feet. And when you have two truckers saying that they're coming in opposite direction from each other, they're concerned about clipping mirrors right now because their trucks are 10 foot across from mirror to mirror, actually in some cases bigger than that, and there's just no place for anyone else to be on that road at that time.
Mm-hmm. And you know, practically speaking, all laws aside, if you're a bicyclist and you're out there and you have a 6 foot shoulder, and there aren't a bunch of those retreads which will give you a flat tire instantaneously, you're on the shoulder. I mean, we could talk about, you know, requiring that, but in effect, when you're a bicyclist out there with a 6,000-pound vehicle gaining on you, that's where you are, unless there's an obstruction there.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd agree that's where you should be. I mean, that picture there, obviously, that's different from the picture on the last page when there is room, but it's, you know, when you're dealing with, and a bicycle does have the right to the road, although they don't pay any road taxes or gas taxes, but the fact is that, you know, if you're on a very, very busy road that's 55 mile an hour traffic, and you're to the left of the fog line on a bicycle going 10 miles an hour, you're a safety hazard.
Yeah, well, the reality, Senator, when you use the argument that they don't pay taxes, no, the bikes don't pay taxes, just like the cars don't pay taxes. It's the people who operate those.
Right.
And there's very, very few people who live and use only exclusively a bicycle. Most of them have a four-wheel vehicle that they are paying taxes.
Well, and that's a discussion for another day. But it's also true that lost my train of thought here. Let's continue to let Mr. Harrell finish. Did I ruin your name already? Carol, I got it.
Thank you, Chair.
Why don't we let you finish your testimony here?
Just the one last section deals with the operation of motor vehicles in bike lanes, and what is proposed there is to add two additional exceptions to the to ORS 811-440, which governs motor vehicles and bicycle lanes. One of those would allow, as your counsel indicated, a motor vehicle to enter the bicycle lane in order to go around a left-turning vehicle. The other one would be in order to avoid a hazard. We'd intended in asking for the legislation to be drafted to make it also clear, and thinking about amendments, certainly if we continue to move forward with this, we'll be asking you to consider amendments that would also make it very clear that before an automobile enters that bicycle lane, just as an automobile in changing any, doing, executing other, any other kind of lane change, that motor vehicle needs to yield to the legitimate occupants of that bicycle lane. And we'll be talking about amendments to make that clear. So, Chair Burdick, that was my piece of the presentation. And Ray Thomas then was going to talk a little bit more, unless you had some additional questions for me right now.
Any further questions of Mr. Perro before we move on to Mr. Thomas? Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name's Ray Thomas. I live in Portland, 820 Southwest 2nd Avenue, Suite 200. I'm a member of the Legislative Committee of the BTA. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I represent a lot of bike riders. I write about bicycle law and safety, and I've pretty much dedicated my whole life to bike safety law. And I also dedicated my weekend to taking some pictures to give to you with the help of Scott Bricker over there, who was one very cold bicycle rider. You go to the back of these materials, you'll see that what we tried to do was to give you a good presentation that puts some photos from real-world applications into the text of the proposed SB 299. So if you go to the first page, it's linked with the second one, and you'll see that basically you've got two people who are starting to cross a crosswalk. The kid and the pedestrian are back at the same speed, starting together at the same speed. But because a bicycle, once it starts rolling, is to keep it upright, you almost have to go a little faster than a walk speed. So if you go to the second page, you'll see that the bicyclist gets a little bit ahead of the walker just because to stay upright in a crosswalk, they started legally, they're crossing, the bicyclist is naturally going to go a little faster. And the thing is that under Oregon law right now, if you go with your wife on her bike and you have yourself on foot or your jog stroller or your rollerblades or your skateboard, you can go faster safely in the crosswalk than your wife on the bicycle, because there's this limit of a walking speed anytime a bicyclist is on a sidewalk or in a crosswalk and there's any cars nearby, which is completely goofy and upside down. So what we think is that if you make it a reasonable speed, or where there's a danger is when the bicyclist may go rolling into the crosswalk so fast that the motorists are startled and can't see them. So that's why we make it so that when you enter the crosswalk, you got to enter at a walk speed, but once you get into the crosswalk, then you can go at a safe speed, which we hope is a step forward to make it so that it's safer, but also more easy to follow the law.
Well, and that's good about entering at a walk speed, because once they're in the crosswalk, they are subject to the pedestrian law, which says the motorist has to stop and stay stopped. And if you've got somebody wheeling in, that can cause a lot of confusion.
Right, and that's what we're trying to do, is to make it more clear.
Senator Beyer, hold on for a second.
Yeah, well, on that note, it seems like if you're going to want to have a bike in a crosswalk, you should be walking the bike, unless, and you mentioned the fact that it's usually sidewalks are for children, and I would agree with that statement. So why, if you're going to do this, why don't you put a limitation on the age limitation of who can be riding a bike on a sidewalk? Because sidewalks are, my way of thinking is sidewalks are for people, not vehicles. And if a bike is a vehicle, as it's described, I could see an exception by age, under the age of 16, or driving age, or something like that, to allow riding a bike on a sidewalk, but not for adults.
Well, Senator Beyer, the thing about the bike is that it is somewhat of a hybrid vehicle. And what it is a vehicle, but it also doesn't have a motor. So if you were to make it so that bicyclists, for the first time, and probably be about the only state in the whole country that does this, which would kind of make us look a little bit like we're outliers, but if we were to make it illegal to ride a bicycle in a crosswalk, then what you would be requiring was a state of change in the Oregon law, which would really be very significant, because in the history of our state, we've never prohibited riding a bicycle. What we've said is that if you ride a bicycle in a crosswalk, you're entitled to the right-of-way relative to motor vehicles if you're lawfully in there, but you've still got the right-of-way so long as you don't go so fast that you're like going 30 miles an hour in a crosswalk. What we're trying to do is to make it more clear, because very few people knew about this walking speed limit in crosswalks. And if you watch kids riding to school, which we're trying to encourage them to do, is to, you know, get out of the car and actually use your body to get yourself somewhere. If you make it so that kids have to get off the bike when they get to the crosswalk, I'll guarantee you, unless there's like some kind of a massive public relation campaign, you're going to make every kid into a lawbreaker. Because it's one thing we can teach the kids: when you come up to a crosswalk, go slow, make sure that it's clear that you got the right of way, and then proceed forward at a reasonable speed. It's another thing to say, okay, right, we're telling you can ride your bike to school, but when you get to a crosswalk, you got to get off the bike and you got to walk across the street. They're going to say, give me a break. What do you want me to ride this bike for?
I did say an exception for children.
Yeah,
if they're to be riding in crosswalks or on sidewalks, but not adults.
But also, I think it's important to note that there's nothing I see in this bill that would preempt cities from having their own laws. Like in Portland, in downtown Portland, you can't ride a bike on a sidewalk.
And the same in Salem and in a number of other cities where it's an urban core area and people are really crowded. Well, then they prohibit bicyclists on the sidewalks at all, because they don't want a situation where people are speeding around on bikes when people are trying to go in and out of stores. And that is something that is a part of Oregon law, has been for a long time.
And this would not preempt that, because that was
a question I wanted to get on the record. This is only applicable to crosswalks. And if you take a look here, you'll see that this is a situation where in the photograph that we used, they're crossing with the walk speed safely in a crosswalk. They've got the right of way. On the same page, if you take a look at the bottom, you'll see a couple of pictures of applications both with cars and without a parked car, showing what a 3-foot distance is. And that's just to give you kind of a tool so you can see what kind of a distance that is. And we're just providing that to you to be helpful. And then if you look at the next page where you see the young man riding on the sidewalk, this is the law that would be requiring that a person go at a reasonable speed on a sidewalk when they're crossing in front of a driveway when there are motor vehicles nearby. At the present time, the law imposes this walking speed rule so that if you were to see a kid going through their neighborhood on the way home from school, they'd be able to go at a regular speed on the sidewalk till they get to the driveway. Then they've got to go to a walking speed until they get to the end of the driveway, then go up. And the trap for the kids is, or for even people who are using a sidewalk to get out of a busy street, is that hardly anybody knows about this walking speed limit. And what we're trying to do is to make it so that we can teach a simple, safe rule, which is you go at a reasonable speed. If you get into a tangle with a car, you're going to lose every single time on a bike. So you go at a reasonable speed, you keep your eyes open, and you're not in a situation where there's like this sort of artificial limit on the speed. So we're trying to make it so that it's clear and easy to teach. And then this next one is a good one, I think, for us, because if you take a look at the suburban, this is western rural Washington County. And the problem for us in the bike world is it is somewhat true. It's as Senator Cruz says, you see some bike riders who kind of make it a matter of principle to get out in the middle of the lane, and we know about that, and that's a problem. We hate it worse than you do, because it makes us look bad and makes people so mad at us. But what you've really got a lot of times, particularly in the two-lane blacktops, is roads like this one here. And so you get in a situation where a lot of folks, when they see a bike rider and a no-pass, and that's what this is a no-pass, the car driver, even if the lane is clear, they feel nervous about going across that center line to give that bike rider the distance. And so it makes them nervous, then we are like looking, come on around, and it makes us nervous. So what we're trying to do is to say, even though the law does allow you to go around if there's an obstruction, what we're trying to do is to say that it's very clear you can go over that center line, so long as there's no oncoming traffic coming, so it's safe to do so, to go around that, those riders. And the thing that you were talking about, to Senator Cruz, is right. It's against the law for bicyclists to ride further out in the lane than as far to the right as practicable. Now, that varies depending upon situation. Sometimes you'll see a fog line that's been painted on busted pavement. Well, you can't ride on that fog line, you know. But it's kind of got to be one of those things where you take the circumstances into account. The next
Madam
page...
Chair, could we add a provision in that to allow people to cross the do not pass line for farm equipment as well? So
well, we have that. There. That was it's the example there? I was going to give.
Okay. It's already law right now.
A lot of people don't know it.
Right.
If it were a combine, there'd be no question you could pass.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this
Absolutely.
Is basically given that same kind of authorization.
Yeah, the law does exist. It says if there's an obstacle or condition. But it's right. It does seem to be a lot of confusion about it. And here's another one, and this is sort of the finale here, another area where there's a whole lot of confusion, and that's this last page, and you'll see my yellow on there. And here's what it's about. Take a look at this picture. Is that a bike lane or is that a fog line? Who knows? But the thing is, if that little Subaru Forester is turning left and this car behind it wants to go around there, under present law, if it's a fog line, it's legal to go around a left-turning motorist so long as you stay on the paved roadway. If it's a bike lane, it's against the law.
Uh-huh.
Now, people already don't like bike lanes a lot because every time they see a bike lane, they think, where's all these bike riders? We're taking up the road and there's no bike riders. So what we're trying to do is to make it so that if there's no bike rider there, why not be able to use the bike lane? If there's an obstacle, if there's a left-turning motorist, just like you can go across the fog lane if you stay on the pavement to go around a left-turning motorist. It keeps from corking the roadway. It's perfectly safe. You just got to make sure that there's no bicyclist in there. Now, there is one thing that's not in the law that came from Legislative Council that we're seeking for you to consider and to please consider as an amendment area. And I put it in yellow. And here's what it is. There is some confusion because bike lanes are kind of a new invention. The law presently allows a person to go into a bike lane to make a turn or to go into a driveway or on official duty, but the law that says that they can do it does not specifically provide, even though it's in the law in a different section, that they must first yield to an occupant of the bike lane. Not only a bicycle, but a motorized wheelchair or any of the other things that can use a bike lane. So what we want to do is to make it perfectly clear that a bike lane is like any other lane. If you're going to go from the fast lane and the slow lane, of course, what do? You, of course, yield to an occupant of the slow lane before you go into the slow lane every single time. And it's the same way when you're in the slow lane and you want to go into the bike lane, you must yield to the occupant of the bike lane, whether it's to turn, to go around a left-turning motorist. And what we want to do is to give law enforcement a clearer picture to show that we're not trying to make the bike lane into this place that no one can ever go. We want to use the bike lane, but it's primarily for bikes and other non-motorized vehicles. So if they're there, you got to yield to them just like any other lane. But if it's empty and there's an obstruction in the road or there's a reason you've got to go around and go into the bike lane, so long as you first yield, it's there for you to use. And we feel like this is not like good for the bikes, bad for the cars. This is good for everyone. We want to develop a cooperative relationship on the roadway so the car drivers and the bicyclists are working together. That's the idea. That's what we're trying to foster. So thank you for listening to me today.
Thank you, Senator Kozanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Thomas, do you also think in that same line that maybe if a person is going to utilize that bike lane that they should actually be required to signal before they enter that area? Because I think that's up for interpretation. I mean, my interpretation, it is a separate designated lane, and it would require some type of a signal to give a warning that they're moving from the one lane into the next.
Well, Senator, I always don't like to disagree with a senator, but the thing is, particularly a biking senator, but the thing is that I think that might create confusion. For the reason that if you're moving into a shoulder area, you don't have to signal. And the other reason is that you can go into a bike lane so long as there's nobody in the bike lane. So the idea is that when motorists are going to make use of this, it's going to be a situation like this where there's nobody around. So you're kind of signaling for
nobody around.
Okay.
And
that
so
that you can see. I tend to. I mean, I hate to take on the bike lawyer.
Yeah.
But my daughter was a bike commuter in Portland, and many times she'd come home and say, "I was almost wiped out by someone who went over in the bike lane and didn't signal."
Okay.
They were turning across it.
Right.
So. I'd like to see if there's something that could be worked out if, you know, in these cases where they are going over the bike lane. I mean, I certainly do it, you know,
yeah.
If I go over a bike lane for any reason.
And that's one of the things that we're trying to do here in that, you know, the bike lane's kind of a new invention. Mm-hmm. Most people, when they went through driver's training, bike lanes didn't exist. And so what you kind of have a lot of times is that motorists are reluctant to do what's called a shoulder check, where you look over your shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of see somebody there and they want to make a turn, so they don't really think about the fact that there might be somebody in the bike lane who they have to yield to first. And Senator Burdick, that's one reason why we're wanting to put this yellow language in there, which says you can use the bike lane to make a turn, but first you have to yield to the occupants.
But see, you gave the best example yourself. You said, you know, if you're in the fast lane and you're making want to switch to the slow lane,
yeah.
You have to yield to the people in the
you
slow lane.
You have to yield,
but you
there.
Also have to signal.
And that's right, and that's Senator Prasansky's point.
Okay, well, if that can be brought in, that would be something that I would be very interested in seeing. The other thing I'd be very interested in seeing is on the sidewalks. You know, this basically puts, as I read it, puts pedestrians and bikers on equal ground. And I think the responsibility is greater on the bicyclist to yield to a pedestrian on a sidewalk. I've had the experience of being a pedestrian with bikes or skateboarders or whoever zooming by.
Right.
And as you work through this language, I would like you to consider language that might make that. I mean, obviously, you don't want to have pedestrians have the right to, you know, walk four abreast and
right.
not yield to bikes. So I don't know how you'll do it, but
Senator Burdick, I can reply to you because sometimes the law is really good, and the Oregon law, if we can get it across to the bicyclists, is already pretty good in this regard. Because first of all, and this is the existing law, bicyclists have to yield the right-of-way to pedestrians on sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
And two, if we pass a pedestrian on a sidewalk, we have to give an audible signal every single time. So there are some real restrictions.
I've never
there.
Got one of those.
I know. No, it's something that...
Get them from me. Survival.
Yeah, and we're trying to teach it because what we've got now are areas where the pedestrians want to be welcoming to the bicyclists, but they don't want the bicyclists to be coming up really quick from behind and almost clipping them as they pass them.
Right.
And this particular law on the crosswalk does not change the fact that the bicyclists must always yield the right-of-way to pedestrians on crosswalks and in sidewalks.
And on multi-use paths.
Multi-use paths. That
okay.
clause remained unchanged.
Okay. Yes. What I would like to... Are there any other questions? Is everyone... done here. What I'd like to do is ask Senator Prasansky to work with you all and on some of the amendments we've discussed, and also to include in that discussion people from TriMet and the Lane Transit District, who also had some of the same concerns on the 3-foot
yep.
Requirement and so on. And I look forward to getting a good bill back that we can all support. Maybe you can put a little language about combines in it. All right. Thank you. Is there any other business
thank
before
you.
The committee? You're adjourned.